for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Some 5 million people bought health insurance through Affordable Care Exchanges run not by their states, but by the federal government. A D.C. appeals court ruled these buyers could not qualify for federal subsidies. A Virginia appeals court said they could. Joining me to explain the implications of these conflicting court rulings, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution. He's also a columnist for The Washington Post. Douglas Holtz Aiken of the American Action Forum. Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News. And joining us by phone from Los Angeles, Richard Hassan, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. I'm sure many of you will join the conversation. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Thank you all for being here.
Nice to be here.
Thank you for being here. Good to be with you, Diane.
Good morning.
Good morning. And first to you, Julie Rovner. This seems so confusing. First of all, what did the courts rule? And second, what will be the immediate effect of those rulings?
Well, let's start with the last question. The immediate effect of those rulings is nothing. So people who have gotten these subsidies in these states, and of course now there's a question whether it's 34 or 36 states. The federal government is actually running the exchange for 36 states. Those people will be fine until this works itself out in the courts, and there is a very, very long way to go.
You're talking about a year or more?
Possibly. I mean, there are some who think it could be a year and a half.
And you're saying people will continue to receive subsidies during that's period.
Right. Even the court that ruled against the subsidies under the rules in the D.C. Circuit, they do not send that back down to the lower court for 45 days to give the government time to ask for a full hearing by the full appeals court, which the government has already said it's going to do. That alone could take several months. So let's start there.
All right.
But what's at stake here is I think what everybody agrees is an inelegantly written line in the very lengthy Affordable Care Act that says that subsidies are only available to people in exchanges established by a state. And then the question is whether I think most people concede that that's probably not what Congress meant. The problem has been that is literally what it says.
So three words. Established by states.
By a state. It's actually four words.
Four words.
But that's what all of this is about, basically, whether or not the federal government in stepping in for the states, which the law also says the federal government shall do if states do not establish their own exchanges. This is a huge it's all about, if you want to be a law student, it's about statutory interpretation. And, so far, all of the judges except this three-judge panel at the D.C. Court of Appeals have said there is no question that Congress intended for these subsidies to be available in both state and
all
federal
right.
exchanges.
And turning to you, Rick Hassan, the divisive political battle apparently is now going to continue in the courts.
That's right. It's going to be in the courts. It's not going to be in Congress. You know, if we were in normal times, what would happen is that often when Congress passes a law, especially a huge law like the health care law, there are going to be problems. There are going to be drafting errors, and Congress would come back and fix it. But we're in such polarized times, and, of course, the health care law is the signature issue of Republicans in terms of trying to get it repealed, that we're not going to get a legislative fix to it. And so we know that the courts are going to be the last word. And so the only question is whether it's going to be these appellate courts or whether this will wind up before the United States Supreme Court.
And how do you see it going?
Well, the next step, as Julie mentioned, is that the federal government is going to go in the case they lost, the one before the D.C. Circuit, they're going to ask for it to be heard by the full court. We call it an en banc court. And when that happens, the court has discretion to take it. I think it's likely the court will take it. thanks to the nuclear option that the Democrats in the Senate put forward, they got more nominees on the D.C. circuit. So there's a there are more Democratic-appointed judges than Republican judges. Quite likely, if they take the case, since this has been dividing on party lines, that the en banc court will side with the same way that the Fourth Circuit did and say that the subsidies are fine even in the federal areas. And then it goes to the Supreme Court in a very interesting posture because there won't be a split between the two courts anymore. They'd both be saying that the law means the same thing, but the court would still have discretion to take it. It's not clear whether they would take it. That's something that we may not know for maybe a year. I mean, it really depends. We're going to have to see. There's a lot of lawyerly maneuvering to go on over the next few months to get a better picture of that.
Right. And before we get into that lawyerly and congressional or non-congressional maneuvering, just how crucial are these subsidies to the Affordable Health Care Act, Julie?
Well, basically, they are, as several of the decisions pointed out, they are an important leg of this three-legged stool. What the law did was it told insurance companies that they had to accept everyone, including those people who were sick. They could no longer, and they couldn't charge them more. In exchange, the insurance companies were supposed to get many more people through the individual mandate, the requirement that most people either have or have insurance or pay a fine. And the subsidies were the affordable part, the Affordable Care Act. So the subsidies are to help people afford that. Now, there is an out in the law that says if the least expensive premium is more than 8% of your income, then you don't have to abide by the individual mandate. Well, the vast majority of these five point some million people who are now in the federal exchanges, they're almost all getting subsidies, and the subsidies are very large. So one would presume that most of them would no longer have to buy insurance if it were to go away. There's yet another piece to this, which is the employer mandate. This is a requirement that large employers, not small, but large employers, either provide health insurance or pay a fine. But the fine is only triggered if one of your employees goes to the exchange and gets a subsidy. So if there's no subsidy, there's no enforcement for the employer part of this.
All right. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, I know you want to jump in here.
No, I just wanted to point out that, in fact, the increases would be quite large for those individuals who've already signed up in these federally run exchanges, have bought an insurance policy, they've got a contract, they've got a premium. If you take the subsidies away, we did a quick calculation that looks like in five of those states, the increases are somewhere between 80 and 95%. In another 12, they're 75 to 79%. And in 8 of them, they're above 70%. And in 11 more, they're above 58%. So I don't think anyone should be confused about the implications of this for the law if, in fact, the interpretation of the D.C. court were to hold all the way through the Supreme Court. It would be a dramatic hit to this law. It would be unworkable in its current form.
It kills the Affordable Care.
EJDL.
I mean, this would simply destroy the Affordable Care Act. Judge Harry Edwards, the dissenter in the D.C. Circuit case, called the ruling of the majority on that panel a not-so-veiled attempt to gut the law, and he also said it defies the will of Congress. And I think one of the mystifying things about this decision is anyone who watched any of the debate over the Affordable Care Act or any of the public statements knows that these subsidies, which are at the heart of it, the whole point is to help people who can't afford insurance to buy insurance at these, that there was never any intention to have the subsidies apply only to the state-run exchanges. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how badly drafted the Affordable Care Act was, and it does not win a drafting award. There's no question. But I was really struck in the Fourth Circuit case, which ruled unanimously that, of course, you can't do what the D.C. Circuit wants to do. Judge Andre Davis had a wonderful line. The judge wrote, "Neither the canons of construction nor any empirical analysis suggests that congressional drafting is a perfectly harmonious, symmetrical, and elegant endeavor. Sausage makers are indeed offended when their craft is linked to legislating. So problems like this, while they maybe crop up a little more in the ACA, these are very common in legislation.
Douglas.
If you listen to the majority in the D.C. court, I mean, they knew exactly what they're doing. And to quote what they said, applying the statute's plain meaning, we find that Section 36B, the key section in the IRS law, unambiguously forecloses the interpretation embodied in the IRS rule and instead limits the availability of premium tax credits to state-established exchanges. Thus, although our decision has major consequences, our role is quite limited, deciding whether the IRS rule is a permissible reading of the ACA. So there's a lot of drama here. There's drama
Lots
on the law.
Drama.
There's drama on
Indeed.
The appeals. There's going to be drama to the Supreme Court. But at the bottom of the drama is a very simple job. This is an administrative hearing. It's an administrative law. And the question is, has the Congress spoken? If it has, that's what you have to do. If there's some ambiguity, the executive can interpret it with the rule. And what they decided was Congress has spoken. Read the law.
Rick Hansen.
Well, you know, there are different schools of interpretation. And the judges on the D.C. Circuit followed what we call textualism, which is kind of a seeing the law more as trying to figure out a logical puzzle than trying to make a law work among people. So, you know, I think, first of all, as the Fourth Circuit opinion demonstrates, there's a good textual argument that if you read the entire statute and try to harmonize it together, that the statute is ambiguous. And second, there's a long history of deferring in the case of ambiguous language to the agency charged with implementing a law. That's something known in the law as the Chevron doctrine. And this is something that really should be up to the executive to decide how to really make the law work.
Richard Hansen, he's professor of law, University of California at Irvine. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking about conflicting judgments by two courts yesterday in regard to the Affordable Care Act. And here with me, E.J. Dion of the Brookings Institution, Douglas Holtzakin of the American Action Forum, Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News, and Richard Hansen, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Here's our first email. It's from Matt in Howard County, Maryland. He says, I'd like to know your panel's thoughts on the idea that the language in question was not a mistake, but an attempt to induce Republican governors to set up exchanges. I seem to remember several Democrats suggesting at the time that Republican governors were putting subsidy funds at risk if they did not set up their own exchanges. I think, says Matt, it was a deliberate attempt by Democrats to get Republicans to cooperate with the law, and it has now backfired. What do you think, EJ?
Well, Matt there summarized one of the central assertions of the people who brought the case, and that is what the majority claims in its decision. There's only one problem with that. There is absolutely not a shred of evidence, not a bit, that this was intended as any sort of incentive. If you take it that way, most of these Republican governors were against the subsidies. They didn't want any of this. So there is just no way that holds up. And that's what the dissent made clear, that you really had to invent this rationale out of whole cloth to justify this view.
I think that's too strong. I mean, there is a letter from 12 Texas members of the Texas delegation in the House basically saying we have to have a national exchange, because if we do these state-based exchanges, Texas won't set up the state-based exchange, and thus Texans won't get the subsidies. So there was a clear sort of division between the House and the Senate as the law developed. There were those in the Senate who felt this incentive mechanism was, in fact, the way to go. They needed to get all the votes. Votes were scarce, if you recall. The House didn't like any of it. They wanted a clear statement that everybody got the money, and this is part of the result. So I don't think you can say there's no evidence, and people have read that record differently.
Julie, how easy would a fix be?
Well, there are already people who are talking about a fix if, you know, 2 years, however many down the line, this ends up being upheld, that the federal exchanges cannot provide subsidies. One of them that people keep mentioning is that the states could simply contract with healthcare.gov, the federal exchange. So the state would basically set up, a paper exchange and then let the federal government do it, that might be one route out, although that would presumably be litigated also. One of the arguments is over how many of these state exchanges are real state exchanges. We've got a couple of states, Idaho and New Mexico, that created exchanges but let the federal government run it at least at the beginning. That's why you sometimes see number 34 and sometimes 36, because of these two sort of hybrid exchanges. And you've got seven what are called partnership exchanges. Court didn't say, you know, what actually qualifies as a state-established exchange.
Two things. One is, first of all, let's be clear. I think the likelihood, and I believe Rick Hassan agrees with this, is that in the end, this is all going to go away. I really do believe that even though the D.C. Circuit Court is unusually reluctant to overturn panel decisions, in this case, in order to get rid of the conflict of the circuits, they are going to take the case. Then you will not have a Supreme Court case. Secondly, I think Justice Roberts and a couple other conservatives on the court will be very reluctant to go against the Chevron decision that says when the statute is ambiguous, and at best the statute here is ambiguous, they go with they let the agency rule. But just on Doug's point, the states that were worried their governors wouldn't take it came along with this suggestion. And there was no question. The Senate said, yes, we will put the national exchange in there. There was no talk of incentives. And Judge Edwards, in his dissent, says this claim is nonsense made up out of whole cloth. There is no credible evidence in the record that Congress intended to condition subsidies on whether a state as opposed to HHS established the exchange.
All right, Rick Hassan, do you want to jump in here?
Well, I think I mostly agree with what EJ said about this is not – first of all, there's not going to be a congressional fix. I think that's pretty clear. Congress is so polarized. Most of the states that are saying no, they don't want to set up a state exchange, are not going to be looking for a way to save this joining this federal exchange. So I don't see a political fix. I see it ending in the courts. But I think EJ's really asked the interesting question. If there's no split, will the Supreme Court take the case? And one of the interesting things is, although you have five conservatives on the Supreme Court, you only have really two, Scalia and Thomas, who are committed to this kind of textualist analysis, which really won't look at legislative history and is really very narrow. And it's not clear that Roberts, Alito, and Kennedy would go along with that. So it's not clear that that the court would divide on party or ideological lines if it does go to the Supreme Court.
Douglas.
So I would agree with Rick and EJ in that I fully expect the D.C. Court to en banc overturn this, right? I mean, that was the whole point of packing the D.C. court. I don't think that means that you're guaranteed not to have a split. There are more cases floating around out there, one in Oklahoma, one in Indiana. We could yet again see this come up, and I think then the Supreme Court would be obligated to take this up. And so I fully expect this to end up at the Supreme Court when we just don't know. As Julie's pointed out, in between, it won't mean anything other than the theoretical argument and the finger-pointing over the Affordable Care Act will continue. And
except confusion on the part
I 100% agree.
Of
yes.
the public. And that's the toughest point, Julie.
That's right. I mean, this now gives opponents of the law the ability to go out and say, in these 36 states, 34 states, however many we're counting, these subsidies that you're getting might be illegal. I mean, immediately yesterday after the ruling, there were questions. It's like, well, would this apply retroactively? Would people have to give their subsidies back who've now been getting them for the better part of a year? So, yes, it does. It adds a layer of confusion, and it will not, you know, whether or not the Supreme Court takes the case will not be resolved quickly.
Which is the problem with judicial activism. I mean, I if I can go farther probably than Rick would go, I think it's very clear that you have a lot of...
Of course you will, EJ. That's what you do.
Although maybe Rick agrees with this. I really think you're seeing in the courts an effort by conservative jurists to say, well, if we lose in the legislative branch, we are going to figure out some way to win in the judicial branch. Because, again, I think that this is such a tortured reading of the law. And just Doug mentioned the packing of the D.C. Circuit. That might also be called filling normally occurring vacancies, which is what the president did.
Do you believe that the D.C. court's judgment was an effort to gut the Affordable Care Act?
I believe that, and so did Judge Edwards, the dissenter, who used that very word, gut.
So let's be clear. The majority said, we understand the implications. It's not something we want to do. We feel compelled to issue this ruling because the Congress spoke, and we in those circumstances, it is not up to an administrating agency to implement a rule. The Congress has spoken.
Rick Hasson.
I think I disagree with both of them. What I'd say is that because EJ is making it sound as though this was a political partisan decision by judges who were looking for a way to gut the Affordable Care Act, I think the causation is a little more attenuated. And what really happens is Republican presidents nominate judges who read the laws in a narrow textualist way, not all of them, but many of them, and that produces results like the result we got from the D.C. Circuit. I don't think these judges are consciously trying to decide for their party, just like I don't think that Judge Edwards was trying to decide as a Democrat. I think they have different worldviews. They were chosen in part because of those worldviews, and we end up with this kind of split, and we see it all across the law, not just in healthcare.
For the record, I didn't say party, I said ideology, and I think that's key. It happens that ideology and party coincide these days, but I think that there is, when you look at what textualism or originalism leads to, in about 80% of the cases, or some large percentage, it leads in precisely the political direction that the justice would pick if they just made a political decision.
Julie.
Regardless of how the judges ruled or how they came to their conclusion, I think it goes unquestioned that the point of the lawsuit being filed was to gut the law, that there was political motive to filing the lawsuit in the first place.
You know, I go back to the public perception of what's going on here. Here's an email from Tony in Tamarack, Florida, who says, I fear we're entering an era where more than ever principles are being jettisoned in favor of results. Once we have laws that do not mean what was written, we are on the road to the end of the republic. It's shameful that court decisions can be predicted by party affiliation. We cannot abandon our system of separation of powers just to get a result we want. Doug.
I certainly would say that the courts are one thing, but I would say exactly the opposite is true in Congress, which is why we can't get this solved. There's been a recent unwillingness to come to principled compromise to actually achieve a result, and instead any deviation from a strong set of principles is viewed as surrender and unacceptable. And as a result, we have this divide and logjam in Congress. So I don't know how you want to characterize this era, but it's certainly not very functional.
But the irony to that is the ACA is itself a compromise, that what most Democrats and liberals wanted was something much closer to a single-payer system, much closer to a Medicare for all. And they said, all right, we know that Republicans, conservatives want a couple of things. They want to preserve the private health insurance market, which this law does, and they want to give as much authority to the states as they want. And so rather than just set up one national exchange, they said, okay, let's set up these state exchanges. Every single aspect of the liberal effort to compromise has been turned into a boomerang against liberals trying to kill this law.
Rick Hansen.
I want to go back to what Doug said about the polarization in Congress. And it really the big change now and the broader picture here beyond health care is that it used to be that Congress all the time reversed statutory decisions of the courts, even the Supreme Court. Unlike a constitutional decision, which is really fine unless we amend the Constitution, when it comes to the meaning of statutes, Congress has the last word. But I did a study a few years ago, and I found that the number of times that Congress now overturns the Supreme Court has fallen to almost nothing. There are almost no overturnings. And the few times when when something overturns, it's when you have one party in control. And so that's a big change from the past. It gives courts a lot more power.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Eric in Dallas, Texas. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Yes. Yeah, it's certainly an interesting question between what the law reads and Congress's interpretation. But if I was the Republican Party, I might want to step back a little bit and watch the law potentially fail on its own, because in Texas, I got a plan under the exchanges from Blue Cross. I was pretty excited to get it. I was one of the first to sign up. Didn't have any problems with the marketplace. And now I have a plan where I really can't find any doctors, and I can't go to a specialist. I can't even go to a specialist for an eczema problem because nobody will take it. They say, we don't take Obamacare. And I've seen a couple of stories on NPR where emergency room visits are up even under the Affordable Care Act because we can't go to anywhere but the emergency room.
And now, Julie, is that because Texas has not signed on to the Affordable Care Act?
No, this is because a lot of companies were faced with the idea we're going to have sick people coming in. We're going to have more expensive plans. One of the ways they save money is by having something called narrow networks. So these plans are different from plans that a lot of people are used
to. Networks are less expensive.
Yes, yes, because they're going to drive. They're going to try to drive everybody to just a few providers, and they cut deals with those providers. But in some cases, we have seen it becomes extremely difficult to then find someone who takes your insurance. And this is something that the federal government is looking at, that states are looking at, whether some of these networks have actually gotten too narrow. But yeah, it's the first year. There are a lot of bumps with
sure.
a lot of these plans.
EJ.
Eric said, a doctor said, I don't take Obamacare. Let's be clear. There is no such insurance as Obamacare. Obamacare facilitates the purchase of private insurance. And Julie described the problems very well. But I want to salute Eric on one thing, which is this is a political question. And if Eric wants to go out there and campaign and say, let's politically repeal Obamacare, that is his right under the Constitution of the United States. And to use a technicality the way the majority did on the D.C. Circuit on this panel to try to avoid the law, that's not the way forward. Let's keep arguing about it. If it works, it works. And if it doesn't, we will eventually repeal it.
All right. To Jerry in O'Fallon, Missouri. Hi there. You're on the air.
Good morning. First of all, I would like to remind one of your guests that the term packing the court applies to actually adding seats, as Franklin Roosevelt did. to the Supreme Court.
Thank you, sir.
not filling existing vacancies, which the Republicans have done in previous administrations. I think if I were a Republican, I would be kind of on thin ice at this point, because as this goes on, I guess I'm taking the opposite tack of the previous caller. People I know that now have insurance in Missouri, which doesn't have an exchange, are going to be getting benefits that will be taken away. And I think you're going to see kind of an opposite effect of people saying, you know, I can no longer afford insurance because of this decision.
All right. Julie, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, this was the other immediate thing yesterday when the reaction was, how might this play politically? And the answer is, now that the law is, we saw in 2012 when Justice Roberts basically saved the law, it had been, much of it was in effect, but obviously not sort of this big piece with people actually going out and getting insurance. The idea of actually taking this away could be not necessarily the politics that those who filed the lawsuit anticipate.
Doug.
I think the political fallout is going to be complicated. I mean, the first thing it does, no question, is it re-energizes the debate over Obamacare at all. And that actually helps Republicans on average. Second thing it's going to do is raise again this specter of executive overreach, which Republicans have tried to use very successfully against the president and hurts Democrats in election year. But after that, when it's whose fault and how do you fix it, it doesn't cut so cleanly.
All right. Short break. We'll be back with more of your calls, your email. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by lumosity.com. Personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through games. Lumosity.com. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show for our July Reader's Review, Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. It's the story of a Nigerian woman who leaves her military-ruled country and heads for America. For the first time, she grapples with what it means to be black. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back to our discussion once again of the Affordable Care Act, to conflicting court rulings that now leave consumers a little bit unsure. Here's an email from Allison in Fulton, Maryland, who says, "We seem to be focused on the law and politics, but do the judges think about the people whose lives this will affect? How can the Republican Party be happy that 5 million Americans could lose health insurance? How could this be good for Republicans? And second, how might this impact the general economy and health insurance companies, Doug?"
Well, I certainly think the courts are aware of what they've done. I mean, again, if you read the majority opinion of the D.C. court, they know this is a big deal. They know it's going to affect the very many Americans who would lose their subsidies, and they're not at all happy about that fact. As far as the Republicans, you know, this has never been a fight about whether people should have insurance. If you go back to the beginnings of the health care debate, the 2007-2008 campaign, the legislative debate, there was agreement there should be better affordable insurance options for every American. There should be health care that had higher quality at lower cost.
But they
and the
didn't
fight
offer
was about,
a plan.
The fight was about how to get there.
Yeah.
And they still have an obligation to get there. I don't think anyone should be confused about that. But you shouldn't confuse that with we don't want people to have health insurance.
EJ.
I don't think that's fair.
Well,
first of all, we have all run into people in our lives who say, I really hate to do this, but I have no choice. So I don't know how you read the language in that decision. But let's take them at their word. I think that this raises the fundamental issue of how people feel now about Obamacare compared to how they did before that we discussed earlier. And that's what we have elections for. And I think we're going to have a really interesting case in Kentucky where Mitch McConnell has been one of the leaders in trying to repeal Obamacare. Kentucky has been one of the quite successful states in getting insurance to a whole lot of people. Repealing Obamacare means taking insurance away from a lot of Kentuckians. And we're going to find out,
and
is that a lie?
Giving
political
it to them in another way, which is the difference between a political statement, which is I want to repeal it and claim
right,
it. That means people never have insurance again. Republicans have consistently said they're going to repeal and replace with a system they like better.
But they have not come up with any replacement, and they keep telling us, as you know, Doug, you would – I have full confidence that if you were in Congress, you'd put up a plan that we could argue about right here. The fact is that we have not seen such a plan. They promised it and promised it,
right,
and they can't come up with it.
I'm going back to the phones to Diane in Norman, Oklahoma. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
The new health care program has saved my family in actual hard cash every month, $1,350 a month. That last December we were paying out, and we now are not paying out that much for the same health coverage. And what I'm thinking is if they win, this is going to literally drive me to the streets to campaign against every Republican in the state of Oklahoma.
Julie.
Well, this, you know, the one thing that is now being seen is that there are a lot of winners from this law. You know, we kept hearing about all the losers, the people who lost their insurance, but we now know, as Doug said, there are other estimates that there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 million people getting these subsidies. The subsidies tend to be very large, 80 or 90% in many cases. It would be a lot of people who would lose their insurance.
And to Warren in Delray Beach, Florida, you're on the air.
Thank you. That's pouring outside. It's more like Delray Beach, Florida. I am listening to this, and I lived in England. My mother was English, everyone. And, of course, what they have over there is better than anything we have here. This is a great country for medical care or anything else. If you're fabulously rich, I think that, well, for one thing, what we have, don't call them exchanges. That's a fancy name. They're bureaus. They're marketplaces. They're not exchanges. I also deplore the term Obamacare. I think that anyone who wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act should be compelled, this is the politicians also, Diane, to declare before the world, I want to repeal affordable medical care.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Julie, do you think that's what's going on here?
That
people want to simply overturn, throw out the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, well, that was certainly, you know, the motivation behind filing the lawsuit was to do as much mischief as possible. And as we pointed out, it would, you know, if this decision yesterday out of the D.C. Appeals Court is allowed to stand, it would do tremendous mischief to the structure of the law. It's worth pointing out, though, you know, this is not the only time Congress has written, you know, inartfully something. In fact, that's where this whole Chevron standard comes from. It's from another case where it was hard to tell what Congress meant. And when you read the decisions, there are dozens and dozens of cases where courts are called upon to interpret, what whether Congress said, whether they meant what they said or whether they kind of miswrote it.
Exactly. Okay.
The last two callers saying, here's what we have gotten out of Obamacare. And I agree with the caller, by the way. We shouldn't call it Obamacare, but we're stuck with it. And even Obama accepted that. But the last two callers show that there are now a lot of people out there who are getting real benefits under the law. Nancy Pelosi was much criticized for saying essentially that we won't know the full effects of this until we pass it. Well, now we know. And I think we're seeing, and Doug might even agree with me on this, that Republicans are making this less of an issue now than they were several months ago. And I think it's because they know full well that there are people out there just like our callers who are actually benefiting from it.
But are the court cases going to reignite that whole debate, Doug?
I think in the end, you know, the president worked very hard to convey the message that it's working. We signed up 8 million people. You can fight about whether that's the right metric for working. It's the law of the land. Let's move on. This undid that in terms of the politics of it. And it will re-energize this from now to November, for better or for worse. I think that's a reality. Republicans have, I think, you know, increasingly recognized that they're unlikely to have supermajorities in the Senate and control of the House and the ability to dictate healthcare reform. And as a result, there have been a lot of different strategies about what to do next in terms of changing this law and getting what they want.
Truly.
The Republicans themselves have a tremendous split about how to proceed on health care. That's why we haven't seen this quote-unquote replace bill. You know, they kept promising there would be one. There hasn't been one. That's because the Republicans are even more divided. You know, the only thing they agree on is that they don't like the Affordable Care Act. They have absolutely no agreement on how they would like to see it replaced.
All right. To Houston, Texas. Charles, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
First of all, I'd say that I agree with you. It's almost impossible to repeal any welfare act. You know, once you get people receiving thousands or tens of thousands of dollars in benefits every year, they will become single-issue voters and activists and fight tooth and nail to keep it, the people who pay hundreds in taxes to support it. You know, it's just one of their issues. And my real reason I called was I never hear anybody talking about the cost of this thing. How much are we spending to provide these subsidies? How much are we spending on enforcement and administration and the IRS and elsewhere? How much? The second group of questions is, I can see where once we've got Uncle Sugar on the hook to pay for everything, a lot of people are going to do what the nurses are doing. They're going to say, hey, it's time for us to get a raise.
All right, Terry, thanks for calling. Doug, how much is all this costing thus far?
This is an enormously expensive initiative. And this is there will be about $1 trillion in spending over the next decade in terms of these subsidies and the expansions of Medicaid. There are taxes that have been posed to help pay for it in part. There are planned cuts to Medicare that are supposed to pay for it in part. That'll impose different kinds of costs as we change networks and things. I don't think you can underestimate that this is a dramatic transformation of the health sector, of the U.S. economy,
and
of which is one-fifth, and the budget.
How much could it save, Julie?
Well, that's the Congressional Budget Office has said repeatedly, although they're no longer doing estimates of the entire law because they can't, because it's too embedded in what's going on. But they do still say that this part, the exchanges, the subsidies, will pay for itself. The funding mechanisms will pay for it. It will not add to the deficit. They've been fairly clear about that.
Rick Hess, I know you're going to have to leave us soon. Do you want to jump in here?
Well, I would just say that the whole discussion here shows that we're very likely facing political paralysis, at least until we have another president on this question. And so it just when Congress and the president are at odds, or when Congress is stalemated itself, it just empowers the courts. And if we're going to tell courts to interpret statutes that are poorly written, which is what we tell courts to do every day, courts are going to have a tremendous amount of power when there are holes and gaps in laws. And that's what we're seeing here, is the empowerment of the courts.
EJ.
Well, I do agree with that in the sense that we, as Rick suggested, we We used to have Congress coming in when there was a small problem with the law. They passed bills called technical fixes, where they took language that was not clear and made it clear. So, yes, at the moment, we have that. On the other hand, paralysis is a bit of a strong word, because let's take what's in front of us. If the courts eventually say all of this from the D.C. Circuit is wrong, we're going ahead with Obamacare, don't worry about it. We are having a very, very important piece of legislation work its way through our national life. And a lot of people are going to benefit from it. There'll be arguments about if anybody has costs. And then we'll have a Democratic debate. So I agree with him that where we are now is at times depressing. But we're also talking about a great achievement here that's working its way through the system.
Oh, EJ, let's be clear about the arithmetic. Someone's paying the cost. This doesn't come out of free.
Oh, I agree. Right. I'm paying part of the cost, and I'm willingly paying part of that cost.
And many people are unhappy about that, and that's a legitimate point of view. So I honestly think that, you know, I've said this many times, the Affordable Care Act was the beginning, not the end of health care reform in the United States.
Yes, I agree.
It will not survive in its current form, whether the courts take it apart or a future Congress and president actually pass legislation to make it look different. I think that's inevitable, because this is, in fact, too costly for what it accomplishes, and it accomplishes too little, quite frankly, on both the insurance and the cost control front. So we're far from done with healthcare reform.
I agree, but for a different reason. In other words, I think that this was what Senator Harkin, when it passed, called a starter home, and that we're going to be at trying to fix healthcare for a long time. And I think the Affordable Care Act will be more effective rather than less effective, but we're still going to need some fixes.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Julie.
I think both of you are right, but one of the important things that EJ mentioned is that Congress's inability to do technical corrections. I mean, this is the biggest bill that Congress has passed in decades for which there has not been a series of technical fixes. That's always the tradition. You pass a major law, you find fairly quickly things in it that don't work or don't work as you intended, not even talking about sort of things that were miswritten, but things that actually need to go in and change. When they passed the Balanced Budget Act in 1997, they did what they called, you know, balanced budget fix bills. I think 3 years running. I mean, because obviously there were things in there. It was an enormous piece of legislation, and there were things that didn't work the way they intended, and so Congress went back and fixed them. But as we pointed out, Congress is so polarized that they haven't been able to do any technical corrections. So this is an enormous change in the healthcare system to which Congress has basically said, sorry, we can't really help you right
Doug.
Now. I'm going to agree. I'm just point out that, you know, this technical fix affects about $600 billion in spending over the next decade, and as a result is far from viewed as technical from the opponents of the bill. And so they're unlikely to say, oh, well, this is just a drafting issue, we're going to let it go. The political stakes are too high for that to happen. And that's why we got the lawsuit. I agree. They knew that this was an important weakness, and they filed suit to try to take advantage of it.
But at the same time, you talk about the spending. If it goes forward, can we realistically expect savings to individuals, to the health care system itself?
So we can certainly expect some savings for individuals. We heard a caller. I mean, there are some people
sure
who have their very expensive medical conditions,
right,
and expensive insurance. They'll be better off. It's an open question still whether the health care system as a whole will cost us less relative to our economy and our incomes, and whether you can attribute that to the Affordable Care Act. That's an open question right now, and a good debate.
What was the purpose of the Affordable Care Act? It was to reduce the number of Americans without health insurance. What are we seeing? We're seeing that the number of Americans without health insurance is dropping. I think that's an unambiguous fact. We also see that it is dropping especially fast in states that have fully implemented the law, including the Medicaid expansion. That's what it set out to do. Will there be problems along the way? Of course, there'll be problems in any big piece of social legislation. But I think lowering the percentage of Americans without health insurance is clearly in the common good.
All right, one last quick caller. Larry in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Good morning. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
It seems to me that this debate and all of the points being made are the inevitable result of the way the bill was passed, and that is without any support from the opposition party, in this case the Republicans. It seems to me that the Democrats took advantage of a moment in time where they had the political power to pass the bill. fair enough. But now to profess consternation when they don't get the support that they would like, when they try to fix the obvious flaws, seems to me a failing of memory about how this thing came to be in the first place.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call, EJ. You're going to get the last word.
I think all kinds of efforts were made in this bill to have it look like bills proposed years ago by Republicans like the late John Chafee. Republicans decided they couldn't vote for it or wouldn't vote for it. I don't know how you can put all the burden on the sponsors of this bill when the other side didn't want to go along. But I hope, just to end on a positive note, that someday we can actually have a constructive debate where instead of talking about repeal, 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 we talk about how to make the thing better. That would be awfully good for our republic.
We'll leave it there. E.J. Dionne, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, Julie Ravner, Richard Hassan, thank you all.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Urblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Ross University.